Today's show brought to you in part by our friends from Keeneland and Keeneland Select. Keeneland contest this weekend, people. You're going to want to get involved in this. You've got the $400 game on Sunday, the $3,500 game on Saturday. Lots of seats, lots of cash, chance to compete against the best players in the country on great racing. To learn more about it, in themoneypodcast.com/Keeneland. We'll also mention that new customers to Keeneland Select have a chance to get a great sign-up bonus this meet. We want you to go to KeenelandSelect.com, sign up using the promo code ITM21, and learn about how you can get your free money. Check it out over at KeenelandSelect.com. Welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. This is our show for Tuesday, October 12th. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornatale, back with you from the Brooklyn Bunker once again after a successful drive back from Saratoga last night. What are the very rare times you can do that drive without much traffic, without having to go at some ridiculous time of the night. But back ensconced here in Brooklyn, looking forward to a very quick trip home before heading out to Keeneland this week. Hoping to get to see a lot of people out there for the contest and all the various things we have going on. My social media will have some updates of that, a few chances to hopefully get together and meet some of the listeners, which is always fun. Joining me on this show to look back at a stakes-laden weekend, as we've had the last couple of weeks, back by popular demand from In the Money, I can't even say my own website, InTheMoneyPodcast.com. He's Nick Tamaro. Nick, how are things?
Morning, Pete. I'm doing great. Good to be with you. Ready to do another one of these. These have been fun so far. It's gotten me, I will admit, it's gotten me quite a bit more excited for the Breeders' Cup than I was a couple of weeks ago.
It is fun parsing through these races and trying to find where the opportunities are. I was just taking a quick peek at the markets, and my overwhelming sense was that more than most years, I feel like the favorites are looking pretty good in a lot of these different races. Now, we'll get to the specifics throughout the show, but generally speaking, is there one of these favorites? And by favorites, I mean, I'm not talking about like second line of the betting types that we've talked about. A few of those we want to oppose. In terms of the favorites in most of these divisions, is there one that leaps out to you that you feel like can be opposed from this far out?
I mean, I guess you probably aren't referring to, you know, somebody like Nick's Go, because he's not going to be an overwhelming favorite. You know, the sort of really top line heavy favorites are going to be Latriska, Life is Good, Jackie's Warrior, and whoever comes over for the turf. But I mean, we'll see who those are as we get a little bit closer. I would think that there's maybe, oh man, that's a tough one.
Yeah,
I guess I'd go against Latriska probably, and that hurts my ears to even hear me say it. If there's somebody in there that can put a little pace into her, but you know, every time I say that and think about her that way, and we'll talk about her, of course, later in the show, I think about the person Lenzen and just say to myself, okay, well, she can go really fast and keep on going. So, Life is Good is a horse that, you know, I'm interested to see who's in there with him. But he's so fleet-footed and going to be so clear of that field. Same with Jackie's Warrior, even though the Vosburgh and Phoenix probably came up better races than we anticipated. He's just a really deserving, overwhelming favorite at this point. So it's not going to be easy for whoever wants to take him on.
Gamine will be another one that will be an overwhelming favorite, I would imagine. And I think just based on her history, she might be the shorty that I'm willing to. I'm not going to like stand in the way of her and let her run me over like a truck. But I think that's one where the half-baked wise guy in me at least has to take some amount of money and say, given the various issues she's had, I mean, all she does is win. I get it. But it seems like, you know, if she's 1-2 or whatever she's going to be, I might be willing to take a stand against. Where do you stand with her?
Yeah, that's an interesting one because it does look like there are real competitors for her. Now, of course, she's beaten pretty much all the main players that, you know, that she'll face, CeCe and Sconson and Belle's the One. Really, the variable is Bella Sophia. So, I mean, Bella Sofia probably presents more of a challenge for Gamine than she's ever faced. And I don't think that they'll be particularly wild about having Bella Sofia attached to their hip right from the start. And so I think that probably presents the biggest obstacle. I think Gamine has been very underwhelming in 2021. I think she's been ridden very conservatively. I think that's generally a negative sign. She has not been particularly impressive. She has not had that speed and brilliance that she showed on multiple occasions last year, including in the Breeders' Cup. So I don't know if she's completely all there physically and if they're not just, kind of cobbling together what they can to get her by, but it hasn't been encouraging. So yeah, I would say that she's one that it feels like after thinking about it and completely overlooking her, almost pretending like she doesn't exist. Which I should probably not do, but yeah, she'd probably be the one I'd be most willing to take on.
I got super excited for a second looking at international prices, on that main page on Odds Checker, they just list the best price, and I saw 8-1 Bella Sofia, but then I clicked in and that's like one outlier book and everybody else is 3, 7-2, 4-1. But honestly, the difference between the 4-5 Gamine and 3-1 Bella Sofia, I think I'd still be leaning 3-1 Bella Sofia at this point. Does that sound reasonable?
Yes, absolutely. I would much rather have her at 3-1. I think the biggest issue that you're dealing with there is just how much you trust a barn that generally has been, I don't want to call it regional, but I mean, Rudy Rodriguez is not shipping horses all over the country because he's never really had to. And I don't think there's much concern there. There's concern, of course, about his ability to win, sending a horse somewhere else. But if that's the biggest worry and you're not really worried about whether she has the ability, it's not a big concern.
Yeah, not when it's being built into the price there. If the prices were reversed and it was a 4-5 shot with a trainer who hadn't had historical success, I mean, hasn't had historical failure really either, I don't think, but at an event like the Breeders' Cup, that's so much trainer angle stuff to me. It comes down to reasons to bet against or include other horses against a solid favorite, or reasons to include an 8 or 10-1 shot. I tend to be very forgiving in that middle cut of the odds range. Does that resonate with you?
I think that makes perfect sense.
Let's talk about the specifics of some of these races, and we'll start at Keeneland with race number 6 from Saturday. It was the Woodford. I had tried to make a case that I regretted pretty quickly thereafter, that maybe Golden Pal and the poor effort at York had shown some indication that he was going off form. This was something that I'm sure you would have predicted with John Velasquez in the irons, gets a more aggressive ride and is seen to better effect. This was a quick pace. Timeform US had the half coded red, gets an upgraded for pace final figure on Timeform of 120. Let me see quickly what the buyer was. The buyer came back equivalent, considerably slower than that. Some of that is stripping out the upgrade for being on top of that hot pace. The buyer was only 88 for Golden Pal. It does seem like he's back in form. Looking at that buyer, it does make me feel like he's probably short enough in the betting right now as a heavy favorite in the turf sprint. Let me see what the latest price on him was. I think I saw it at 2-1 a little bit earlier. What did you think of this effort from Golden Pal? What do you think he's going to look like in the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint? And yeah, 2-1, best price available right now for that race for him.
Yeah, there was a little cat and mouse. I think that John Velasquez was trying to play with the field. And I think that he was probably a little bit unprepared for Firecrow to make the move into him at around the quarter pole that he did. One thing I'll note about as far as speed figures go, the turf course on Saturday, they were kicking up quite a bit throughout. And I know that that's generally the case in the fall at Keeneland, but I think that course probably had a little bit more give to it than it may have been given credit for early on. And I guess what I'm trying to say without saying it, so I'm just going to say it, is who cares about the buyer figure? I mean, it's just one of those where it's a final time fig made on a course that probably was carrying moisture, where they went what looks like a really hot pace. He completely crippled. I shouldn't say crippled. He completely buried the other, that's even better, the other speed horse, and just went on about his business. I mean, and Firecrow is not a bum, but I mean, he was getting away from him 5-6 lengths at the finish. So I thought this was a really strong effort. Yeah. I thought this was a really strong effort. You know, I think the question with him becomes 5/8 is a Del Mar is kind of a pinball race. It's a fast race. Is he quick enough to get the lead? If he does, can he just wire everybody, you know, a la the winner in 2019, whose name I don't remember, the filly that won for Peter Miller, Belvoir Bay, that just blitzed everybody from the outside. I mean, I think those will be the tactics. So unless Wesley Ward has some other interesting international engagement on the horizon, I would assume that he'll be in the Breeders' Cup and he'll take an awful lot of beating.
Yeah, you make fair points. I may be being too cynical, too desiring to get against some of these favorites just because of how with them I am in other spots, but clearly going to go there as a heavy favorite. It'll be interesting to see who turns up against him. If having European success in this race finally means we'll see a few more competitors. But as we were talking about on the show the other day, of all the turf sprint configurations that you might see at the Breeders' Cup, you would think the 5 at Del Mar would be particularly tricky for the Euro Invaders. We'll see. Plenty more to come on that division and that race. Let's move on to the TCA, which was as race 7, and Bell's the One gets the job done by a neck at even money. What did you think of this effort from her, and do you think she's got an opportunity to step up and take down the likes of Gamine in a few weeks' time?
You know, up to this point, I think we I was concerned that the track at Keeneland was playing a little too kindly to speed, and was actually thinking that in the midst of Biz could make it 2 straight TCAs if she was able to get the lead. And, you know, assuming the timer is right, which I imagine it is, given the way the race played out, there were 4 horses within 2 lengths of each other going 21 and change. So I guess that was sort of medicine for all of my whining over time about there not being enough pace.
I had a similar thought on myself, not at your expense, but at my own. Like, okay, here's some pace in a race that didn't look like it was going to have any.
Exactly right. Those are always the most fun. But I thought, you know, Bell's the One's favorite track is Keeneland, and I was glad to see Neil Pessin run her back after the narrow miss to Wisconsin at Churchill, and she ran very well. You know, I expected. She was expected to win given her price, but she gathered those horses in very quickly around the outside and, you know, got to the front probably a little bit earlier than she normally does given her style. And so Club Car actually put a little bit of a charge into her in the final 100 yards or so. But I thought it was a very solid effort. I thought it positions her well to try Gamine again. She has not tried her since Kentucky Derby Day. And that was not one of Bell's the One's sort of signature efforts. She ran, you know, just okay, not any better than that. So he seemed a little reluctant afterwards to commit her to the Breeders' Cup because of the challenges that'll exist with shipping and, you know, going all the way to California. I imagine she'll be there. She certainly has earned a place in the field. And I think we'll see she'll give Gamine a better shot than she has at any point thus far. Whether it's good enough, of course, is the question, but it's nice to see a good hard knocking horse like Bell's the One put another graded stake on her name.
That one came back 113 on Timeform US, no upgrade or downgrade for pace. And it was a 99, a little bit faster on the buyer scale for Bell's the One. If they decide to go there, if she's doing well, if Gamine isn't touting herself in the mornings, she's one I could see ending up on some tickets, at least. Very, very, very cool filly, and a good description by you of what went down there the other day. Let's move on to race number 8, the First Lady Grade 1 action, back on this good turf. And stop me if you've heard this one, Nick, a Chad Brown exacta in a Grade 1 turf stake.
I know. I, you know, we've got more races to go through. What was more shocking on Saturday, that Chad Brown won a Grade 1 on turf at 15-1, or that he had this exacta here, and I think it paid $89 or something like that, paid very well. And, you know, this race was, and you and I talked about this race on the plus side to as far as the 2-day pick 6 went. And I was a little bit more critical of Blowout than you were. But we both had doubts about the quality of the four-star Dave. But of course, recognize that the fall turf at Keeneland can often be very, very kind to speed. And it seemed on paper as if she had an appreciable pace advantage. And so with a guy like Flavian Pratt, by the time they got to the backstretch and she put her ears forward, I thought to myself, well, this is going to be very, very difficult for everybody else. And she really repelled the challenge of her stablemate, Regal Glory, impressively. And, you know, Blowout is kind of a hard luck horse. right? She had a very good 2020, but she lost a number of decisions right on the wire. And her stablemate Viadera got the better of her a couple of times. And it's like immeasurable how much better Blowout ran than Viadera in both of those races. And of course, as often is the case, when those horses run against each other enough, it evens out. And now Blowout is a grade one winner, and Viadera is as well, but Viadera is just not at her level. So these are horses that ran well. They're going to both be candidates, I would imagine, for the Matriarch. I don't think they'll be in the Breeders' Cup. I did see Chad Brown said flat out, Regal Glory is going to the Matriarch. And he could entertain the possibility of sending Blowout to the mile, you know, perhaps on a let's try and bottom out the field type of mission with the horse from Woodbine now being repointed to the Breeders' Cup. I think he'll think better of that and probably save her for a race like the Matriarch. I would imagine that's a better opportunity to put another grade one on her name. And Peter Brand is expanding his own breeding capabilities. We're going to give everybody a little bit of insight into this race that might pay off a little bit quicker. And I'll let you, of course, answer some of what I said, but then include that Empress Josephine was a very solid third in this race and is going to pull off the Aidan O'Brien 7-day turnaround and run back in Saturday's QE2, which yeah. I think is very, very interesting and perhaps could be, although maybe not be, given the conversation that we had, I was going to say could be bolstered a little bit by some wet weather that's in the forecast, but she might be a filly who prefers firmer turf. So we'll have to see.
I was impressed with quickly. That run.
I thought yes. she did very well. Yeah,
she really did. And this was one where I was, you know, hey, the words that you never hear around the racetrack, great morning line. mean, remember, I was saying 10-1. This is a bet at 5-1. What is this 10-1? She goes off 11-1, but she does run very well and was really the one coming best at the end, even being able to hold off Althequa. Now we did also predict the possibility of a very quiet ride on Althequa that may have compromised her chances. What did you think? Did you feel like Althequa's chances were compromised by the ride, or did you think that it just wasn't her day?
You know, I wonder. I think a little bit of both, perhaps. I wonder if Althequa hadn't been, you know, I think she was somewhat fortunate in both of her wins here. I think they were impressive races. I just think the way this thing shaped up, being kind of a big field and her having to negotiate that, trying to come through tight spots and do the things that she did, I thought it would be tough. And I think it all sort of worked against her, not to take anything away from her performances in the Just a Game or the Diana. She just didn't seem to have that same ability to quicken. And maybe it was where she was positioned or, you know, her sort of reluctance to be between horses. She kind of lost her spot in mid stretch, but it really didn't matter. She wasn't coming with enough force to hold her position. So it was an underwhelming effort. And maybe, you know, we saw the best of Althequa in the summer, and now she's just getting to be a little over the top.
102 buyer speed figure for Blowout. It's very similar on time form. 121 for the form figure, upgraded a point off the raw 120. But this looked like decent form. And yeah, I think you're right about Empress Josephine. I would say, I think people are going to be a little bit confused by the 7-day turnaround. But particularly from talking to horsemen, in an off Lasix world, I see no reason why Empress Josephine should have any trouble with that. I think the only question is going to be, what's her price going to be? And is it going to be a thing where we look at it in a few days' time and say last time was the time at 11-1 you wanted to be keying around her to get into the try as opposed to whatever she's going to be in the QE2. But I guess it all depends who shows up. What's your knee-jerk reaction, though, with Empress Josephine as to whether you'll be with or against her in the QE2?
I mean, initially I would say with, I think that this is, you know, this is something obviously done with a great deal of intent on O'Brien's part. And I kind of wondered if that was the thought when I saw her in the PPs for the First Lady. So no, I think it's interesting. I mean, I'm willing to see what the field comes together like. Otherwise, I think the best American hopeful is technical analysis for Chad Brown, who won the Lake Placid. I would imagine that she'll get a relatively, you know, forwardly placed trip. I did not see that Con Lima was a probable, I don't know if she's even working. She, of course, won the Saratoga Oaks, so you would imagine that she'd be the kind of filly who was in there. And otherwise, I don't think there's, none of the horses coming back from that silly mile and 3/8 race at Belmont will run. So Colima is not working, so she will not be participating. And I think that'll make technical analysis probably the toughest local hopeful. There was another, the list I saw had another Euro possibility. So yeah, we'll have to see. Yeah, we'll have to see who that might be. And
we'll know very soon, right? They'll draw.
They'll draw tomorrow.
We're recording this Tuesday. They'll draw tomorrow. I'm excited to be there for that. You'll hear elsewhere on the show about the Keeneland contests over the weekend. We'll give another plug to those. The QE2 will be one of the big races in the big Saturday contest. If you remember the old school Keeneland contest, the order is kind of flipped now, where it used to be Saturday was the $400 game and then the bigger money game on Sunday. These days, with out-of-state participation, et cetera, real estate not being as big of an issue, you do get the $3,500 contest on the Saturday and then the smaller money one on the Sunday. Are you still drawing live to potentially come, or is that idea out the window?
I'm coming.
You're coming. Yeah, I'm in. Fantastic.
Yeah. So I will be there Friday and Saturday.
Has Pat Cummings made us dinner plans yet?
He has. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to talk to you about it after this. So we're in.
We don't need to hear. The poor listeners don't need to hear about that. We'll give them a recap. That's always more interesting. But no, that's great news. Oh, I'm glad we went on that little tangent.
Yes.
Let's move on to this Breeders' Futurity Grade One action. I think I get credit for. I might have had the winner as my second pick, so I can't really claim it. Rattle and Roll does a good job. That two-turn experience proves important in this spot. The race comes back pretty slow, 103 on time form, and I think Beyer was very, very similar for this one. I'll dig for that while we're talking. But there's going to be a few races today that we talk about from here to the end of the show where my comments are very similar. It was an 81 on the Beyer speed figure scale where I say something to the effect of all credit to Connections for getting it done in such an important prep race. But man, this horse is going to have a lot to find come Breeders' Cup time. That certainly sums up my feelings about Rattle and Roll.
I think that's completely fair. I think that, if you weren't dealing with a year where Jack Christopher was looking like a potential headliner coming off of the solid Champagne performance, and of course, our friend Corniche, who I don't want to beat up on anymore, is very highly regarded. Rattle and Roll is looks like a nice, nice horse. And I was very surprised to see Ken McPeak kind of foreshadow a more conservative approach by potentially saving him for the Kentucky Jockey Club. Wondering, I guess, or worrying that he might not be able to turn him around 3 weeks after the Breeders' Cup for that race. So we'll see if he ends up going. Based on Kenny McPeak's past performances, I think it's pretty likely that he'll go. I would be surprised if he doesn't. He's a horse that could benefit from a fast pace, no doubt about it. And obviously the thing that you give yourself the possibility for in going is an Eclipse Award. So, I mean, you kind of, now you're talking about stallion dollars and things like that. So there's a lot of upside to going, aside from having to bring a two-year-old into a spot like that so early on. But, there was a lot of conversation about this race, especially on social media. And I know that Twitter is not indicative of how the real world works, but the conversation about Classic Causeway, and there was some chatter early in the week by various provocateurs about the morning line and specifically Classic Causeway, who was 5-1 on the morning line, which was ridiculous. And there was a kind of a misunderstanding about his debut in terms of the speed figure that he earned. And we talk a lot on the show about speed figures, and look, I used to be a figure maker. You talk a lot about Timeform US and Beyer, and we'll reference the Thoroughgraphs occasionally. It's very important to understand that looking at a figure and not giving any consideration, and perhaps this tangent was better suited for the Vosburgh, but and not understanding what happened to make it happen. Think about the guys that you've heard on these airwaves, like Paul Matisse and Mike Maloney, who will talk to you, who've made a living doing this, will talk to you about understanding how races are run. That's what has to happen. So for a horse like Classic Causeway, who got a 90 Beyer, which, by the way, has come back and been validated by multiple horses, including the runner-up, when he got loose on the lead sprinting, and then for him to come back and take this, 15-18 point regression, trying to go to wire a field from the 13 post at a mile and a 16th, that doesn't mean that his initial figure was wrong. So, I understand we live in like this either or world where things can't possibly be nuanced. You either are or aren't, or you're on or off. It's not that simple. right? So understand that that the reason why he earned that figure, the reasons are clear, and why he took a little bit of a step back here are also clear. What I want to figure out about the balance of this field, and it really is irrelevant because the horse is you know, may not even be on the dirt for much longer. Where did Stellar Tap's debut come from? I know it completely fooled me, but this is a horse that has now come back and run. I wanted to give him an excuse for the Iroquois. He didn't have much of an excuse for Saturday's performance. And, you know, I've been meaning to look up and see how a lot of these Steve Asmussen two-year-olds ran back when they surfaced elsewhere who had won impressively at Saratoga. I mean, obviously you can think of Gunite and Echo Zulu, one of whom ran very well, the other of whom ran very poorly, but that was just, he got into contention around the turn and then completely stopped. And in what was a pretty ugly performance. So I continue to be perplexed about that particular horse.
Yeah, I don't have much of an answer for you about that. I suppose in the case of both the runners you just mentioned, you could also look to the distance as being an issue, I guess, and say, hey, maybe these are horses that are suited for the cutback. But it is weird because that Stellar Tap debut was 7. So you would think that that's going to portend a horse. And just looking at the breeding, Tappet and Medaglia d'Oro, the horse is supposed to be better going longer. And you could also say the same thing, I think, about Classic Causeway, Giants Causeway and Thunder Gulch, supposed to be better going longer. So maybe not the ideal for cutback candidate. I think it's going to be tough for me, and it all will depend on who shows up in prices, of course. But my knee jerk on both of them is to probably be against just coming out of what can only be described as a slow rendition of this breeder's futurity. Sounds like you might be a little bit more forgiving, especially where it comes to Classic Causeway.
I would be forgiving for him probably down the road. I highly doubt Lynch will send him. I know he ran third, but you know it doesn't look like a race that's going to suit him very well. So yeah, I'd be surprised if he ends up going. I think he'll they'll take a more conservative route. You know, I could see him potentially being. I mean, if they want to continue on this year, he could potentially be like a Remsen horse or a Kentucky Jockey Club type, I would think. So with the quality of Jack Christopher and Corniche and, you know, some of these horses we've seen run well in the preps, it just doesn't look like a good spot for a horse that might be a bit of a need to lead type that could also be a little distance limited.
Let's do a tangent on Jack Christopher and the increased buyer speed figure. As somebody who has made figures, I don't know if you looked at this case specifically. I don't know if you agreed with the upgrading of the number or not, but I know you have thoughts about the overall intelligence of raising a speed figure after the fact as evidence comes to light. I'd just like to hear you opine a little bit about the decision to raise that number up to an extremely solid 102 that wins the juvenile most years.
Yeah, you know, I've always laughed at the notion that buyers become irrelevant because they're changed. And, you know, it's like, well, would you rather somebody tell you something that they know might not be accurate or make an attempt to try and make it as accurate as possible? And you'd obviously choose the latter 10 times out of 10. So, you know, when the outcry of people that come forward when a buyer figure has changed and say, oh my God, you know, who made this decision? And oh, these things are just ridiculous. They move them around all the time, so on and so forth. You know, that's silly. So obviously after the Champagne, which, you know, we talked about last week and gave every indication that it was a very fast race. It played out like a fast race. The margins were huge. The time looked like it was very solid when you stack it up with the other times from throughout the day. And most importantly, they've had massive timing issues at Belmont this entire meet. You know, it's been something that they've tried to fend off as much as possible, but this was clearly a race where it didn't smell right, much like the Frazetta day later. So, you know, what Andy Beyer did was, with the help of Craig Milkowski, who's the, you know, sort of the timing maven now, and I'm very familiar with how Craig does it, and he has studied it and he has done it a lot of different ways that help you get to a good conclusion. There's basically two different ways to retime races, one of which is to time the entire race and then back out what the expected value is basically for the run up. And the other is to try and do it from the poles, which is difficult because you can't get, you know, you can't always get the perfect angle. So Craig is very, very smart, very sharp, has done this a lot and obviously got this number right. And so in doing so, Andy Beyer and Mark Hopkins adjusted the speed figure up to 102, which makes it obviously one of the fastest two-year-old figures earned in the last 10 years. I think Bolt Doro's American Pharoah is the only other 100-plus fig that we've seen recently. And, you know, I think when everybody settles in and starts looking at pre-entry PPs in a couple of weeks, they're going to realize that this horse is going to be very formidable. And he's going to be a very, very tough favorite to take on, given his speed and his ability to stay forward and the fact that Chad Brown knows intimately how to win this race.
Let's talk about race number 10 from Keeneland on Saturday. We got the Keeneland Turf Mile Stakes here. In Love for Paulo Lobo, no stranger to success in this one, scores with a 120 on the time form U.S. scale. What did you think of this race?
You know, I think the biggest takeaway is I don't know how long it took me to get over the stench of the performance from Order of Australia. It was very, very poor. And I guess that I don't want to say I kind of knew he wasn't going to run well because he didn't really have any speed. But he got himself into position relatively well. And then it looked like John Velasquez kind of cajoled him along a little bit down the backstretch, and there was just nothing there. So, I mean, you knew it was going to be a relatively honestly run race with the horse coming up from Florida. Hector Berrios sends everything. So he put that horse on the lead, Brown Storm, and Diamond Oops was forwardly placed on the stretch out. Tell Your Daddy was close. I'm Like It Hot Brown was close. In Love actually ended up being, I'm sorry, Ivar ended up being a little bit closer than I expected, but he was just a length or so ahead of his stablemate. In Order of Australia made this move, you know, kind of on the outside, and I'm being generous and calling it a move before really flattening out. And Alex Achard always had In Love in a prominent position well in advance of some of the late runners like Space Traveler and Pixelate, who generally are going to be a little bit up against it on a, you know, on an autumn turf course at Keeneland that really played a little bit more kindly to forwardly placed types. And this was a great ride for, you know, a relatively young, somewhat, you know, unheralded rider like Alex Achard, who waited, got outside, got the split, and this horse just exploded and ran by everybody. Paulo Lobo now with consecutive wins in the Keeneland Turf Mile with 20 plus to one shots. So good to see small barns winning races like this. So, I think it's relevant as far as the Breeders' Cup Mile goes? If anybody in this country or listening or anybody that can get to us wants to tell us what their big opinion in the Breeders' Cup Mile is, I'd love to hear it. I mean, it seems as if, based not knowing what's coming over, it seems as if it could be the most wide open race of the weekend by a distance. So I wouldn't discount anybody. You know, I guess I probably shortchange Mo Forza personally, but it's just because I'm sort of waiting on whatever shipping over, anticipating that they'll be better.
It's hard. There's some very, very, very big names in the betting who might be shipping over. So once we see that, we'll have much more of a handle on this race. But if for some reason we don't get those top of the line Euros coming over, I agree. If the domestics have any shot in the race, it's going to look extremely open. Was there any story around about what happened with Order of Australia? I mean, that was, as you said, just dismal, but just seemed like something went wrong.
Yeah, I didn't see anything. Well, In Love was only 12 to 1. That was a kind of a fail on my part. I thought he was a bigger price. I didn't see anything. And you know, to be honest, I would probably not believe whatever it was anyway. It would have been some excuse about the ground or, you know, stuff like that. And it's you know, he won the Breeders' Cup Mile last year on ground that was so cut up. It's you know, whatever this was nowhere near that caliber. So it was yeah, it was just an uncharacteristically dull performance. And, you know, it was right when we started telling everybody that he had sort of proven himself. Yeah. And now he took this massive step backwards. And
it happens.
Things in flux. Who are the big names on the list right now? Is it one of the, I mean, not Palace Pier or Poetic Flair, right?
They're both listed in the betting. Wow. Palace Pier at 3 to 1, Poetic Flair at 9 to 2. So, you know, that's certainly an open case. Ben Battle listed in the betting higher, 12 to 1, Alcohol Free in there at 12 to 1. So there's, it's just, it's one of these things that's almost not worth thinking about until we know exactly what's happening. But we're definitely getting, those are prices that are low enough that they're suggesting to me that there's serious consideration being made to making the journey over. And it might be, I mean, it feels like those are the two scenarios, a dominant euro at a shorter price, or just something completely crazy and wild happening. I'd like to cover both of those scenarios potentially.
Yeah, you know, and I'm not altogether shocked about Palace Pier obviously being trained by John Gosden, who's a huge supporter of the Breeders' Cup period, but specifically, it seems like John Gosden has sent even better horses when the races are in California, in large part because he knows he's getting fast ground. So it's that's something that I'm not terribly surprised by. Look, Palace Pier being in this race, this would be the best Euro miler in the Breeders' Cup since, you know, fill in the blank. I mean, it's been a while since we would see one with these kind of credentials.
Oldakova was the name that popped to my head when you said that.
Seems likely, right? I mean, it doesn't. We've not had anybody that was that kind of top shelf since then. You know, right, because we had the Teppan years in 15 and 16. 17 was not a big, that was world approval. 18 was won by the Judmon horse that was nowhere near the caliber of, you know, Palace Pier. So, yeah, I mean, it's Goldakova, and before that, probably Rock of Gibraltar, you know, those kind of horses. Not that the Palace Pier is quite at Rock of Gibraltar's level, but hell, I mean, you look at his form for this year and the races he's won, you know, what is he, four group ones in three group ones in a row. So yeah,
he's very, rock very, solid. Yeah, yeah. Rock solid. Definitely top miler in the world type conversations. And what a great addition to the Breeders' Cup. Now we're a little bit pressed on time here. Do you have a hard out?
We're good. We're rolling.
All right, let's go through these Belmont races, starting with race number 6, 2-year-old fillies in the Matron. Bubble Rock gets the job done. This was a race coded fast for the first two fractions by Time Form US. 3-2 favorite for Brad Cox. Makes no mistake. Didn't have the greatest start. Came a little wide, maybe from a trip point of view, from a pace point of view. You could upgrade this a little bit with Bubble Rock attacking into those fast fractions. What do you think about her going forward?
I got to watch a few more replays to make a better determination on the inner turf at Belmont, which felt as if you wanted to be a little bit towards the inside at various points during the weekend. But Bubble Rock ran very well in her debut. She ran even better in her second start, and I think she took another step forward, which is no great surprise. She's a horse that seems to be very handy and a very good fit for Irad Ortiz, who wants to be, you know, sort of stalking and pouncing when ready. So I thought she was solid. You know, do I have a, you know, great insight into whether she's a Breeders' Cup type of horse? I mean, I imagine Brad Cox will send her. There's not a lot of opportunities for a turf sprinting filly as we get towards the winter. And so, yeah, it would seem to make sense that he'd want to run her at 5 furlongs. And she looks like a horse that would be a contender to me, you know, without knowing. I guess Averly Jane's kind of one of the heavies in this division, given her performance on Sunday. And Bubble Rock would seem to be just sort of a, you know, a notch below those types. I guess the filly that won the race at Kentucky Downs that Lady Danae had been in would also be a contender. But I did think that Bubble Rock showed some maturity in having to kind of run around the outside and get the job done. So, you know, not a performance to be bowled over by, but solid.
Averly Jane was very good on Sunday. That was an 86 buyer as opposed to the 83 buyer that was notched in the Matron. But yeah, not far behind by any reckoning. We should get to those Sunday races too, real quick anyway. So we'll continue to rock and roll through what happened at Belmont on Saturday in the Hirsch Grade 1 action. Very unusual looking pace line on Timeform US, where you have a 6 furlong number coded red and then a 1.25 mile number coded blue. In the end, it was that same story we talked about at Keeneland, the Chad Brown exacta, this time at a little bit bigger prices, though.
Much bigger prices. And, you know, a race that played out like a complete collapse. And, you know, it's funny. Rock Emperor is a horse that had been ridden by, you know, seemingly every talented rider in the room and had had a variety of different opportunities and had failed every single time. But he always showed you just enough to keep you coming back for more. you know, he showed that he had some ability. He could compete. You know, he lost the race last year, the Manhattan, in just what was an unforgivable performance. And so I kind of tried to divorce him at that point. And, you know, here, lo and behold, he gets an opportunity with Javier Castellano. We find out afterwards that Chad Brown was putting a different bit on him. And he became one of the horses that, despite having been a little headstrong and a little aggressive in recent starts, he actually relaxed better at a mile and a half. Who knows? You know, maybe it was good recent training. Maybe the fact that the blinkers were coming off would be a little bit more helpful. But here he was, I mean, in all his glory. And this is a horse that hinted at having pretty serious ability going all the way back to the Belmont Derby in 2019, which was won by Henley's Joy, who has not won a race since then. And here's Rock Emperor winning a Grade One. So it was a pretty shocking performance, to be honest. I didn't expect it at all. As it ended up, this was a much faster paced race than we would have anticipated going a mile and a half. As Channel Maker, who just, you know, now we know is not the same horse that he was last year, and for whatever reason. And so I would imagine he's going to be retired pretty quickly. And Arklow was ridden very aggressively by Jose Lascano, and I think that actually worked against him in the end. But yeah, what a great ride. I'm actually watching the replay as we talk, and Castellano kept Rock Emperor held up, and it actually worked perfectly. He may have won this race by more, potentially. I just want to say one thing about Gufo. I've never been a big Gufo fan, and I don't feel validated at all in him running the race that he did on Saturday. He finished third. He made a big middle move, and I think Joel Rosario got a little, I guess, uneasy about what was going on pace-wise. The other problem is that Gufo is not the simplest horse around. He kind of waits when he gets to the front, and he only has that sort of one bid, which is why I never really thought a mile and a half would be his game. I'm surprised he won the Sword Dancer. It's also worth noting that for everything that happened, he held off Channel Maker by a length. So, I mean, he didn't exactly finish this race very well. I'd be surprised if they go on to the Breeders' Cup with him. I don't think he can be competitive with those horses.
I was wondering, it seemed like such an un-Rosario ride, and I was wondering if the sort of bumping, and this is one that got to go back to the tape and have a look. I was wondering if some of the bumping that took place early on in the race got him lit up and was part of the reason for making the move into that fast part of the race that eventually did end up collapsing. I'm not talking about a race necessarily like the Breeders' Cup Turf, but I was inclined to be forgiving of Gufo because it just didn't seem like his representative type effort. I don't know how good this form is going to be, you know, especially when you're talking about a race like the Breeders' Cup Turf and who's ever going to show up there. But I have always looked at Gufo very similarly to how you did. And his recent run of success has stuffed me in a locker more than once. But this time around, I was inclined to be a little bit forgiving that moving early might be what took the sting out of that finish and made him look weak late. And if he gets his more customary run and setup against the horses that he usually faces, not necessarily the best of Europe, that he could be able to get that condition arrow going back in the right direction.
Yeah, I think when push comes to shove, he's probably at his best around 10 furlongs. And, you know, I think other than maybe in kind of an extreme scenario pace-wise, I don't know if he can be successful really any other way. And this was the classic upside-down race flow, right? The 1-2-3 finishers were 4th, 6th, and 7th at the quarter-mile call and the half mile call. So, I mean, this was a race that was just won in about as unpredictable a fashion as you could have imagined, which was Rock Emperor coming from last and basically going last to first in a matter of a couple of furlongs and pulling clear. So, you know, what would I do if I owned Gufo? I'd point him to the Pegasus Turf. I feel like at a mile and 3/16 early in the season, you're going to get modest participation from some of the heavies. And he really just doesn't fit in anything else right now. You know, he's not. And don't get me wrong, I'm not dumping on him at all. I think Gufo's a nice horse, a multiple Grade One winner. I just think that he was a little fortunate to win the Sword Dancer, certainly the way he did. Because look, Japan came back and ran poorly as well. You know, he was really never involved. And
a lot worse.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he got beaten by, you know, basically a length and 3/4. But again, it felt like a lot more than that because you never even really called his name. So these are horses. Japan is a horse that, you know, even though he ran somewhat poorly in this race and did run well in the Sword Dancer, the horses that could potentially come over, the names that were being seen discussed for the Breeders' Cup turf. I mean, Japan is a joke compared to those horses, right? I mean, there's no comparison whatsoever. Japan is a horse that had some good days back in 19, but he's just never really gotten back to that level. Now he has had a better 2021 than we, I guess, expected, but still, I mean, he's a horse that's just not quite up to snuff when you're looking at some of the names we're seeing. So I think it'll be tough sledding for anybody in there. I read that Rock Emperor will go. I don't blame them. You know, they have a kind of a new lease on life with this horse now, with the new style and the, you know, maybe the new equipment. And at this point, why not?
Yeah, it's a pretty impressive opportunity. And when a horse like that gets good, the hands he's in, 103 on the buyer speed figure scale is not far out of it. And you know, you get paid for finishing in the top several numbers there too. We'll see who shows up. I mean, if it is Tarnawa and Mishriff and Herrick and Lane and, you know, some of these others who are being suggested, you know, there'll be some Coolmore rep, whoever that ends up being. It ain't gonna be easy, but I mean, it's essentially a free roll to nothing for a horse like that, I would think, at this point. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him move forward at all to a spot like the Breeders' Cup turf. Let's talk about these Sunday races at Keeneland, and then I promise I'll let you get on with your life. We talked about Averly Jane a little bit beforehand. We don't have any time for him. U.S. data, I was a little bit questioning about the switch to the turf, but Ward shows once again he's pretty adept at moving them back and forth between surfaces. An impressive display of speed, gets the job done at 4-5, and I think has to be considered a big contender for a race like this, juvenile turf sprint at the Breeders' Cup. Did you have anything in here that impressed you or you were interested in as far as the Breeders' Cup or any future spots, or was this just straightforward?
It seemed pretty straightforward. The odd thing, of course, was the equipment change being made with the blinkers coming off, which makes little to no sense that you take them off of a three-time winner. But it didn't make a difference, right? I mean, she just blasted to the lead and improved her position with every call. Looks to be an incredibly talented horse, and one that I would imagine, if you're looking at the Breeders' Cup turf sprint, the juvenile turf sprint, you know, what comes over from Europe for that race is not going to have much speed. And quite honestly, I think we have a big advantage domestically in that division anyway, because we generally press our horses more for speed early. It's why Wesley Ward has had so much success. So yeah, I mean, she's shaping up a pretty short price. We didn't talk about the Futurity at Belmont, which was on Sunday, which, you know, we could touch on very quickly, but I mean, it didn't look like a race where anybody is going to come out of it and be a major Breeders' Cup contender. So you're talking about Bubble Rock and Averly Jane. There aren't really many horses that are going to come from the West Coast, so she looks to be a pretty solid favorite at this point.
Let's move on and talk about Latruska, who I think you pretty much founded the bandwagon back before the Apple Blossom, if I'm remembering that correctly. Gets fairly loose in the spinster, puts up a 101 buyer, gets the job done. I will say this, depending if we were convinced that there was, you know, multiple speed types in a race like the Distaff, I think I'd have to take some shot, just given how famous she is at this point, how that bandwagon founded by you has grown. But I can't really give you a proper form and figures type reason to be against her. She kind of just looks like the goods.
Yeah, and I think when everybody sits down and starts to look at the PPs and sees them stacked against each other, what they're going to find are a bunch of horses, A, that she's beaten already, and B, that she's just a lot faster than. And so I think that's the one horse that she's going to face in the Breeders' Cup that you could see having at least some – there's going to be some way to back her if She Dares the Devil, because She Dares the Devil and Latruska are actually 1-1, 1-1 head to head this year. She Dares the Devil beat her in the Zeri, and then Latruska beat her in the Ogden Phipps. I think people sort of are a little bit more dismissive of She Dares the Devil. I know I've been, because I mean, Latruska she pounded her in the Ogden Phipps. It wasn't close, and She Dares the Devil couldn't keep up with the half mile pole. So Brad Cox sort of astutely went a little bit more conservative route, did go to the Clement Hirsch, and then got a win for She Dares the Devil in her final prep. Now, the other thing is that She Dares the Devil won by a neck over Crystal Ball with En Voutant in the mix too. And these are horses that Latruska just pounded. So, I mean, it seems as if everything points to her just being so much better than all of these horses and continuing what's been a really fun and enjoyable campaign. You know, we just don't see this anymore. You know, horses that run in January and March and April and twice in June and August and October and now November. And he's already talking about running her as a 6-year-old. And she just fires every single time. She has one blemish on her whole year. And that was a narrow miss where they kind of got forced into slightly different tactics. So it's going to be tough to beat her. I don't see anything out there, you know, having watched and looked closely at the final preps pretty much everywhere. She looks like a pretty strong favorite. You know, like you said, if there was another pace type in there that could maybe inject a little bit into it, maybe Private Mission is the kind of horse that could be a little bit problematic for her. I could see maybe Bob Baffert trying to run two and seeing if one could just go on kind of a suicide mission on the front end, perhaps. I mean, those are.
Are you suggesting that Bob Baffert might use team tactics in a graded stakes race?
Given past performance, I don't think any race is too would it be beneath Bob or above Bob? If you can do it with a triple crown,
I think you can book that it's going to happen.
Yeah,
and it's actually a good point as to if you wanted to make the anti-Latruska case, I might start there.
Exactly right. And if you could do it in a race where the triple crown is on the line, you can pretty much do it anywhere. So, that's kind of the only thing I can think of right now. But it is time for us all to. And I think everybody is, but embrace and celebrate Latruska because it's been a really fun campaign. And I would imagine that, you know, she sort of has a live draw at Horse of the Year. You know, if she wins the Distaff and the Classic is won by anybody not named Nick's Go, Essential Quality, or maybe Hot Rod Charlie, then she's the Horse of the Year.
It'd be an interesting thing to see. And I'll tell you this about her, team tactics or no, she might be able to shrug them off. We've seen that move from Latruska before as well, just being faster and better. It's going to be, I'm actually really looking forward to that race. Very quickly, a couple of other stakes on Sunday. The Bourbon Stakes, Tis the Bomb. Maybe the most impressive thing to me is this horse not just breaking through, but running off for a furlong or so, getting back in the gate. You know, it's funny, I've seen a few, the last couple of breakthrough the gates I've seen have actually come back to win, but I swear there was maybe 100 I saw in a row before that did not. But Tis the Bomb justifies favoritism. This was a ginormous full field. For the division, the figure comes back okay, and I'm tempted to upgrade it based on what happened before the race. Came back a 74 on the buyer scale. Looks like a big hope to me domestically for the juvenile turf. Were you as impressed as I was by Tis the Bomb?
I thought he ran very well. I agree. Yeah, I thought it was a strong performance. You know, looking at it in comparison to some of the other races we've seen in this division, it doesn't stack up. But it was a solid effort. He's looks to be a talented horse, and I would imagine, you know, he'll have a. This is why I think Kenny McPeak will end up running Rattle and Roll, because he's got a couple horses to send over. So this is a horse that it was obviously a huge weekend for McPeak as well. You know, I just don't, I guess what was my difficulty with this race, and again, as you said, you don't often see horses break through the gate and then come back and win. This was a big field. It just looks like a bunch of horses that are going to be running for a tag for, you know, next year, right? It just doesn't look like. There was nobody in there. And I guess what I'm using as sort of my reference point is not even just Portfolio Company and Annapolis, but, you know, even McKinnon that won the Zuma Beach at Santa Anita, you know, those are horses that look like they still have upside. And I mean, I bet the Bobby Medina horse that ran, that stalked in second and then ended up tiring late. I don't know. I guess he seems like a decent enough horse. I just don't know about him elevating his game against some of the best horses we have of the domestic types and potentially some of the sprinters. I will say that he was more forwardly placed than I realized and still finished, which is notable because the pace was strong. So, no, the Bourbon just seems year in and year out like it's a race that always has a loaded field because everybody takes a shot. It's very evenly matched. and it very rarely produces anybody of any great ability because they're just, you know, the horses that we kind of thought they were going in.
On figures, you are certainly supposed to prefer Annapolis and in his rival there from the Chad Brown barn, who looked so good and put up those big numbers in the Pilgrim. I mean, the Pilgrim looks like better form, but I'm not a Portfolio Company, the horse I was thinking of. I'm not going to be ruling out this one as one to have somewhere in the mix and for underneath based on what was shown. And of course, this is another one where it could get thrown into complete. We could be looking at it a different way, depending on what shows up from Europe in this spot.
Yeah, no question about it. I'll tell you who I thought actually ran very well in there was Mike Maker's horse, who finished second. And I think that he's a horse that, given that those connections won this race last year, I could see them potentially trying to come back and do it again with a big priced horse. Because it's worth noting that, you know, this race was run at a very strong early pace, though it never really fell apart. The pace setter fell apart completely, but the horse who was sitting second, I want to say finished sixth. And, you know, he was sort of losing ground late. I guess what I'm alluding to is that, you know, the autumn turf course at Keeneland is often very, very kind to front running types. And, you know, I benefited from this once in my life, being as obtuse as I am, recognizing that it was a speed favoring course when La Coronelle won the QE2 a few years ago and figuring that she would be on the lead. So, and the reason why I say kind of upgrade the Maker horse to finish second named Stolen Base is that he sort of made the only real move from way off of it. There's a period of time around the turn where Tis the Bomb actually gets a little bit shuffled out. And it's, you know, this is one of those situations where you have to watch races closely and not take any kind of comment line or anything too literally, because he was actually helped by being shuffled out. And what I say by that is he got held up in the point of the race when the running really started to quicken, and it enabled him to then get back outside and finish as the race was starting to weaken late. So it was a solid performance. I would probably be more inclined to bet Stolen Base next time out, especially if there was confirmed speed. So it's, you know, we'll see. It was a race that I think I had a decent idea what was going to happen going in. One of the horses that I thought could win ended up winning. So I'm, you know, I'll be ready to move on.
That's funny. I agree with your point about Tis the Bomb and the trip. To me, the part of the trip that was interesting and made me optimistic was much more about the breaking through and whatever distraction
that would cause.
But yeah, it is funny. Nobody ever makes that point that you made, though, so I'm glad you did, about how not all trouble is created equal. I mean, the most simplistic example, just to underline the point, you know, getting left can be great when it's a giant pace meltdown and it enables you to be the one who's moving last when everybody else is gassing out. And I think this is a bit of like a baby version of that, where it's all about ending up in that right attacking position late. I think they're both kind of interesting horses, but plenty to find with the top two from the Pilgrim. But, you know, for exactas and trifectas going forward, I think they're probably both worth keeping on side in a race like the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf, depending, of course, on what all ends up coming over from the other side of the pond. We'll be covering it all. Nick, we'll have you back on. Hopefully we'll get you doing some writing maybe too about some of these Breeders' Cup races over at the site. Of course, folks can find you every racing day in New York with your analysis over at inthemoneypodcast.com. I even said it correctly that time. Nick, thank you so much for getting up early with us and talking about all these key Breeders' Cup preps these last 3 weeks. We'll have you on again very soon.
Sounds great, my friend. I enjoyed it and looking forward to inching a little closer to the Breeders' Cup.
We will be back with our next guest right after this. Join the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation on October 21st for a horse show like no other. Gather your friends and family at 8 p.m. Eastern for a live stream to see, hear, and feel the profound impact that the retired racehorses of the TRF have made on countless lives through their Second Chances program at the Lowell Correctional Institution in Ocala, Florida. Visit trfinc.org for more information. Also, Lexington area people, I will be hosting a viewing event at Mirror Twin in Lexington on October 21st. We'll gather at 6:30. there's a suggested donation, I think, of $10. Come by. I'll buy you a beer if you say you heard this ad on the show. That'll make you up almost all of that $10 donation that we're asking for that one. October 21st, Mirror Twin, 6:30. Be there.
Next up on the show, very happy to bring in a man who's a fellow podcast host. You've probably heard the Can Do podcast. And if you haven't, what are you waiting for? A lot of great material there, including the recent series about the foundation of the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation and the Second Chances program. I'm speaking of Bill Duncliffe, here to talk about an exciting new project he's been working on. Bill, how are things?
I'm doing great, Pete. Thank you. And thank you for that introduction. I hope I can live up to all that hype.
You typically do. So I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good about that.
Right.
I wanted to, first of all, why don't you tell folks about this little endurance test you've been putting yourself through? What's been going on?
Yeah. So it was my 65th birthday. And just thinking about that kind of milestone and some of the work that I've been doing with the podcast, thanks to the help of you and the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, I decided for the Second Chances program, I would do a fundraiser that involved a walk that I have actually done before. I did 7 years ago for a local children's cancer classic around here in Boston called the Jimmy Fund. And that is a walk of the actual Boston Marathon route from Hopkinton, Massachusetts to Boylston Street in Boston. And ironically enough, today is the Boston Marathon for 2021, which typically takes place in April. But I wanted to schedule it around the birthday. And, we inaugurated this fundraiser with TRF and Kim Weir and the terrific people there. And so far, we have raised $4,500 for this Second Chances program. And I'm hoping that with the help of your listeners and the continual kind of publicity, et cetera, that I'm doing on social media, we can get a lot more in there. I selfishly am hoping we can get maybe $6,500 for 65 years. We'll see.
I like that idea. Yeah. I bet you we can get there. You know, I know there's a lot of people, a lot of regular listeners who do give. I was thinking this could be a good opportunity for them. And that's not bad. I mean, you got to figure the In the Money listeners, especially with as hot as we've been on the shows lately. I mean, last weekend, all you had to do was listen to our free stuff and you came up with the opening day Keeneland late pick five, and then we came right back with the pick six on Saturday. So if we've helped you in any way lately, this is a good excuse to get involved, as we like to say, you know, putting the horses in the hearts of horse players around here. And there's a few different ways you can give. You know, we have our page, of course, the trfinc.org/players, and I would imagine through that you could find a way to earmark the money for Bill. I want to talk about the inspiration for the idea. You said you'd done it before. What made you think to connect it to Thoroughbred Charity? I know there's some backstory involving a mutual friend.
So you reached out to me earlier this year and invited me to leverage the podcasting I've done to support the TRF and to do something on Quick Call and the Second Chances program. Quick Call having been honored this year at Saratoga with a marker in Clear Court as one of those Saratoga specialists. We did a three-part podcast earlier in the summer. The first one was with Andy Serling, and we talked about Saratoga specialists and specifically about Quick Call. Then the second part, I spoke with Kim Weir, who is our mutual friend, as you said, at the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. And the woman who formerly was the superintendent at the Wallkill facility, which was the first Second Chances program site. And then in the last segment, I ended up talking with three graduates of the program, and they talked about the changes that they had made in their lives. And, I think that's when I first actually got the idea for the fundraiser because, Pete, I mentioned it on my fundraising page that, I consider myself one of those people that there, but for the grace of God, go I. And, when talking with these graduates, I was very moved by the fact that, in one case, she was just doing something that any one of us have done many times over the years and made a bad choice, or had a bad outcome. And, you know, and the other is they had kind of rough upbringings, but they all used the Second Chances program to turn their lives around in a very positive direction. And I was just very, like I said, I was very moved by it. And I thought, you know, there's more that I can do here. I was grateful for the opportunity to publicize the program, with the podcast alone. But I thought, you know, there's a lot more I can do here. And, I think 65 is one of those birthdays people tend to dwell on. And I had been thinking about it a bit, I think one way that you want to think about milestones, any kind of milestone, is what more can I do here? And mm-hmm. and so it all kind of came together from a timing standpoint. I'm really pleased to be able to do it. I'm praying for good weather on Saturday, this upcoming Saturday.
Yes.
When we do it. But we'll get it done. I actually one of my hiking buddies who I actually introduced Johnny K to hiking many, many years ago when both of our sons were Boy Scouts, and now he has totally eclipsed me in the hiking area. But he is going to do it with me, so it'll be good to have a trusted companion, a fellow companion, someone who I've spent a lot of time on the road with doing it. And we're going to get started very early in the morning, we'll take as long as we need to get it done.
Do you have a goal? Have you thought about it in terms of time and all the training that you're doing, or is it, you're really just going to see what happens?
We're just going to kind of see what happens. When I did it in 2014, I'll tell you a funny story. You're a marathoner. I know you're a long distance runner. And one of the things that they tell you when you do Boston is don't go too fast too early, because it's the first 15 or so miles is really pretty much downhill.
Yeah, a lot of hilarious stories about young runners getting very full of themselves early in the Boston Marathon, only to be passed by the grizzled vets
exactly.
A couple hours later. Yes.
Well, that happens to us older walkers too. So when I did it in 2014, I was with my sister and my brother-in-law, and they were like, Billy, because that's what everyone in my family calls me, Billy, is like, you're going really fast. You need to slow down. And I was just trucking along. I, thought I could make it. Well, everyone knows Heartbreak Hill, and for those who don't know the minutiae of Heartbreak Hill is actually a series of four hills. And it's really the last hill that is Heartbreak Hill, which is short but steep. And so we had rounded the corner at Newton, the firehouse at Newton, and we had done the first three hills. And at the time, I was thinking it was just three hills. And so I realized very quickly that Heartbreak Hill was really well named, because when I got to the top of the third one and I looked up and I see that the spires of St. Ignatius Church at Boston College is still up above me, I was like, you got to be kidding me, because I'm kind of cooked at this point. But we did make it to the top. And the last 5 miles, I was like, I paid the price for going, walking at a 4+ mile an hour pace early. So we'll take our time. We'll just take the situation as it comes. As long as we finish before daylight ends, we'll be in good shape.
I think you'll be able to manage that. And I will say, in whatever athletic endeavor I'm practicing, that there are those times where I think to my favorite thoroughbreds and the way they just continue to find and give in those adverse situations when the needles weigh into the red. I find inspiration from horses in my own stuff. I would imagine on this walk in particular, that's something you can draw on.
Oh yeah. And that's a really good point. I'm actually doing some work later today. I'm talking with Al Stahl. And later this week, I'm going to talk with John Sheriffs about the 2010 Breeders' Cup Classic. And, talk about two horses who are, who gave their all, for a fantastic race. But I also think about those, my Roxy girl in New York won again the other day. What is she, 7, 8 years old now? She just shows up every month and runs her heart out. Those are the ones that they're the heart and soul of the sport, really. And it's really rewarding to be able to watch those ones just continue to come out and give their all. And just in general, as you said, these – I'm happy to be able to do something for the program because, you know, it gives these horses a second chance as well as the individuals. And they, let's face it, they run their hearts out for us. And that's,
they deserve it.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
They deserve it more than as much as anybody, and to be able to combine the two. So I was also wondering about the connection. I know he's very proud of what you're doing, but another mutual friend of ours, you mentioned the Kim Weir connection, obviously, but Mark Kramer, the legendary handicapping author, yeah. who I yeah. knew back in the day. I knew him in another life and then reconnected with him. He's been on a couple of shows recently and is going to be on again in the near future to talk about the re-release of his book, Please Hold All Tickets.
Yeah.
But we had him on a Horse Player Happy Hour, and he was mentioning that years ago he had done a fundraiser for a biking fundraiser, yes, for the TRF, and he was extremely happy to see you carrying this torch, as it were. And I was wondering if he was a partial inspiration in some way, or if that's more of just a happy coincidence.
No, definitely. That's a good point. Mark is and has been. I first met Mark many, many years ago after he and I were on a message board that was on Yahoo at the time called Diomed, and I had hit a pick six at Aqueduct, and Mark interviewed me for it. And part of my reason why I was able to hit it was because I had read Mark's book about angles and handicapping and thinking about things differently. So I've always kind of, followed Mark. And yeah, he did he called it his own Tour de France, yes. Mimic the Tour de France over there is, where he's was living and still is living. Mark is just a terrific writer about all things, really.
Yes.
Talking about his experiences at the races in France and the French countryside. And, Kim talks about this too, and Mark is a real proponent of it. We all have individual things we can do. People would love to change the world, and I'm not minimizing anybody that wants to do that. But sometimes, and this was really my dad's philosophy too. My dad's philosophy was always just make that world around you a little better, the immediate world around you, and focus on that. And Mark very much has done that. I was pleased to be able to reconnect with him and interview him for, my podcast as well. He's, he's a terrific conversationalist and just a unique thinker just an easy person to talk to, very pleasant.
Well, let's put it this way. Just as Kim has inspired us, Mark has inspired us. I want your story to inspire other people out there to come up with their own interesting fundraising ideas. What can I do to help? Hey, we could have you on here to talk about it. I don't know. I'm not going to promise every single person who does a fundraising project that will have an ability to get the money, but I wouldn't be surprised when it comes to going out of my way to help the herd over at TRF. I'm pretty good at putting my money where my mouth is. So I'll talk to Kim about this and see. In terms of setting up the fundraiser, though, it wasn't like there was a ton of bells and whistles, right? It was pretty much started with an email to Kim.
No, it was very easy. After I interviewed Kim and had the inspiration, I reached out to her and she set the web, she said, well, what do you want to say in there? And do you want to include a picture? And I sent that over to her and the web page was up. And then, I have been publicizing it on my Facebook and my Twitter feeds and sending out, private emails to friends of mine. And it was very easy. I think really it's one thing to get it set up. And like you said, it is very easy, but I have been trying to be very diligent about getting the message out to people. And really some of the people and the donations have just all of the donations and it's just been very flattering. And some of the nice things people have said, it's really very appreciated because that 4,500 where we are right now comes from a lot of people. It's very meaningful to me.
It's great. It's fantastic. And I'm loving this idea, whether it's part of a charity fundraising effort like what Bill is doing. I have a big birthday coming up. I say coming up, not till next year, but it is one of those round numbers. And maybe there's something fun we can do and set up. Or the only limit here is our creativity, folks. And I just, as you can tell from how often we talk about it on these shows, how much this program specifically means to me and this ability to reach human lives and equine lives. It just, and of course, just how much I love working with Kim. It all fits together. And Bill, I'm really happy to have you on here to talk about it. And breaking news, I should have looked at this before we came on the trfinc.org/players page, very close up. I think it's maybe like the second hyperlink on the page after the one about the horse show coming up on October 21st. Remember, folks, to tune in for that. But it says right here, check out Bill Dunclyffe's Walk for the Horses. So you can go right to that page from there. Perfect. And support Bill. And then, of course, we're going to have to talk to you. We'll probably leave you alone during the actual marathon, but perhaps we can button it up with one more chat next week if you're game.
That would be great. I would love to do that. I would love to do that, Pete. Thank you.
Cheers, my friend.
All right. Thanks for having me on. And I look forward to updating you. Sounds great.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. I'd like to thank Bill Dunclyffe and Nick Tamaro for their contributions. Our founding partners, the TRF, you heard about them earlier in the show. Also, 10 Strike Racing. Around here, we always like to root for the purple and the black. Keeneland and Keeneland Select, we thank them as well for their continued support. But most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners, for making these shows so much fun to do. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Coatney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos!